It is Wednesday, November 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the death toll in the California wildfires climbs to 50. British Prime Minister Theresa May seeks cabinet approval for a Brexit deal.
There is incredible dispute really within the Conservative Party and across Parliament and across the country about this deal.
And Samoa pleads for global action to tackle climate change. It's all ahead. Search teams in the U.S. state of California have found more bodies in areas ravaged by the most destructive wildfire in the state's history, bringing the overall death toll to 50. Crews are working with cadaver dogs and a rapid DNA analysis system in and around Paradise, a town of 27,000 people. Authorities said more than 200 people were still unaccounted for as the searches continued and the fire advanced to the north and east of Paradise. Wildfires are common in California, particularly at this time of year when warm, dry winds help quickly spread flames. In addition to the so-called campfire in the northern part of the state, two smaller fires in Southern California have killed two people since last week. Kathleen Shorey is a CAL FIRE information officer, and she spoke to me of the latest death toll.
Yes, between both fires, the Camp Fire and the Woolsey Fire, that is what's currently being reported.
Turning first to the Camp Fire, what is the situation with that blaze? How is that being treated?
The fire is currently 135,000 acres with 35% containment. Last night, the firefighters were able to hold the established containment lines. They are still providing structure defense and are working to strengthen and improve those control lines.
But apparently the town of Paradise is pretty much destroyed.
The town has definitely sustained significant losses. There's about 7,600 single-family residents destroyed, 260 commercial structures destroyed, and the multiple residents count is 95. We're still doing ongoing damage assessment, so that number may continue to rise.
And then I know there are a number of people that are missing, and I'm sure authorities are trying whatever way they can to find these people.
Yes, absolutely. The sheriff's office is handling those missing person reports and searching for any remains.
Well, now looking at the further south into the state, the Woolsey Fire, what is the status with that fire?
That fire is currently at 97,620 acres with a containment of 47%. The structure's destroyed. The current count is at 483. Similar to the campfire, that damage assessment is still ongoing, so that number may rise as well. The good news there is the Santa Ana winds are going to continue to diminish throughout the day, and firefighting resources are going to pursue those opportunities to build an improved direct line to minimize any further perimeter growth and support their containment objectives.
Well, just turning back just briefly to the campfire, apparently this is now considered the most deadly fire in California history. It has surpassed that of the Griffith Park fire back in 1933.
Yes, that's correct. The Griffith Park fire reported 29 deaths and we're at 48 on the campfire currently.
It's probably too soon to know this, but have state fire officials learned anything for the future that they can try to contain or reduce the devastation that these fires have caused?
Well, we're always in a learning process. Right now, we're just concentrating on trying to contain the fire at hand and handle the emergency situation. We always do look at incidents after the fact. With the wind that was present the day that this fire started, it just was incredible speeds that moved this fire at tremendous rate.
All right. Well, unless there's something else you wanted to bring up, I thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Not a problem. I think just the only thing that I'd like to share is when the authorities come and indicate that it's time to evacuate, we hope that the people will heed that advice and get out early so that the responders can get in to help abate the emergency.
CAL FIRE Information Officer Kathleen Shorey speaking with me from the California State Capitol, Sacramento. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Fox News and other news organizations side with CNN in its legal fight to regain the White House press pass for reporter Jim Acosta. The Israeli defense minister resigns. A rights group calls for a halt to the repatriation of the Rohingya, and Democrats are gaining ground as more U.S. votes are counted. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study by a pair of researchers at the UK's University of Reading suggests the massive bombing of Europe by Allied forces during World War II not only caused devastation on the ground, but also impacted the ionosphere as well. The ionosphere is the portion of the upper atmosphere ionized by solar radiation. Along with other functions, it impacts the global propagation of radio signals. The study authors reviewed records kept between 1943 and 1945 by the UK's Radio Research Center. These records contain the daily measurements of the ionosphere. According to the study, there was significant reduction of electron concentration in the atmosphere on the days when the Allies conducted their bombing raids in Europe. The study suggests that shock waves caused by the intense bombing may have heated the upper atmosphere, which increased its loss of ionization. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the alleged Mexican drug lord El Chapo goes on trial in New York. We'll have a report. British Prime Minister Theresa May is trying to get approval from her cabinet for a draft agreement on the terms of Britain's exit from the European Union. Negotiators from Britain and the EU reached a deal Tuesday after lengthy negotiations, but details have not been made public. May must convince her senior ministers to support the agreement, which would later also need to be approved by Britain's parliament. Jamie Detmer in London tells me about May's struggle for cabinet approval for the agreement.
Well, I mean, the draft agreement runs to 500 pages, and then there's a five-page, and that's about the withdrawal. About the conditions for the withdrawal, and then there's a five-page added document about what possibly, but it's very vague apparently, the future trading relationship between Britain and its former EU partners will be. The deal lays down basically, as far as we know, because it hasn't actually been published publicly, that Britain would remain in a customs union for a transitional period of 3 to 4 years while it is negotiating another trade deal. And it did that. London requested that customs union in order to avoid any checks on the border separating the Irish Republic and Northern Ireland. But there is incredible dispute really within the Conservative Party and across Parliament and across the country about this deal. It's very unclear whether she will get approval from her cabinet today. The cabinet is meeting this afternoon as I speak. Even if she does get cabinet approval, no one can really work out whether she can get this approved in Parliament. The mathematics of the parties really in the House of Commons really would suggest that she can't. So really what's hanging in the balance is both her prime ministership, the Conservative government, which is a minority government, and Brexit itself, and certainly this deal.
Because certainly what the so-called hardline Brexiters, people like Boris Johnson, would they agree to comply with this?
No. Boris Johnson has gone out very firmly disapproving it, saying that it locks Britain into a customs union and having to obey rules and regulations from the EU, which we'll have no say about at all. And there probably, the estimate is, about another 60 Conservative MPs, Brexit-favouring MPs, who will oppose. But it's not only the Brexiteers who are opposed to this. So are the pro-Remain MPs within the Conservative Party, including, ironically, Boris Johnson's brother, Joe Johnson, a former minister. He too, like his brother, resigned over the whole Brexit negotiations. And as well as that, you've got a growing number of Labour MPs who have suddenly realised that in their constituencies, people are changing their minds. And polls now suggest that in Labour heartland constituencies, a majority now favour remaining in the EU because they're afraid of the economic fallout from exiting the EU.
Would it be possible, would there be perhaps a second referendum on Brexit?
Yes, I mean, I think the odds really have increased on a second referendum in the last few weeks, and I suspect this deal really have increased the odds even more. Labour is half committed to an idea of having a second referendum. Most Labour lawmakers want another vote. The leader, Jeremy Corbyn, who's been very lukewarm throughout his career about the EU, isn't very convinced by it. But the problem really faced by the political establishment in London is if there is no agreement by the cabinet, no agreement by Parliament on this, then it means that Britain would likely crash out of the EU without a deal, which would have tremendous economic implications for the country. So the most likely outcome, if Parliament doesn't approve, is either an early general election and or a second referendum, which people call here a people's vote.
Jamie Detmer reporting from London. The trial of Mexican drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman opened in New York this week, with prosecutors portraying the 61-year-old as a ruthless operator who flooded the U.S. with massive shipments of illicit narcotics as head of the Sinaloa drug cartel and left a trail of violence in his wake. The defense insists Guzman was a scapegoat, pointing the finger of blame at co-defendant Ismael El Mayo Zambada, who remains at large. He's accused of bribing current Mexican president Enrique Peña Nieto and his predecessor Felipe Calderón. Both men deny the charge. Guzman, who was extradited to the U.S. nearly 2 years ago, faces multiple charges such as trafficking, firearms violations, and money laundering that could send him to prison for life. Duncan Wood, director of the Wilson Center's Mexico Institute, spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty, and he said the allegations of bribery are extraordinary, but hardly surprising.
For a long time, we've been waiting to see what El Chapo will come up with in court, and we fully expected that he would implicate senior Mexican government officials. We were not sure that he would go as high as the presidency, but all of these allegations have to be taken with a pinch of salt, and it'll be very difficult to establish the evidence to prove these allegations to be true. The allegation, or the accusation rather, against El Mayo is somewhat surprising, because El Chapo and El Mayo held the Sinaloa cartel together for many, many years. And I think that's the kind of evidence that U.S. authorities and Mexican authorities are looking for, is to try to unravel the internal organization of the Sinaloa cartel, to try to really establish how it worked as an organized crime group, and to see what the internal structure was of that. And so it'll be fascinating to see in the coming days and weeks of this trial exactly what kind of evidence can be presented in court about how that organization was actually put together.
Jury selection was a real challenge. Some people feared for their life, didn't want to serve.
This is an extremely powerful organization. At one point it was considered to be the most powerful organized crime group in the world. In recent years, and in particular since the extradition of El Chapo Guzman, the Sinaloa cartel has been weakened. It's begun to fragment and has faced stiff competition in western Mexico from a new cartel, the Jalisco Nueva Generación cartel, which has begun to take over some of the territory formerly controlled by the Sinaloa cartel. But yes, I mean, there's no doubt that the long arms of organized crime stretch deep into the United States, and so people were justified in their concerns about giving evidence or rather participating in the jury. But, you know, the United States is a very different place than Mexico. The United States has institutions which can provide effective protection for witnesses and for juries.
Is this a bellwether trial for other potential trials of drug kingpins from Latin America?
I think that we have to say that this is the marquee trial. This is the one that people will refer to for years and maybe decades to come, as we see what the most powerful organized crime boss in the world at one point comes up with in court. And it really will shed light upon the internal workings, both of Mexican organized crime and of organized crime's relationship with the Mexican government.
Duncan Wood of the Wilson Center. He said the tragedy surrounding this trial is not just the American lives lost to drug addiction, but the tens of thousands in Mexico who died as a result of narco violence. He sees little hope to break this vicious cycle, but says there are what he called clues to combat the cartels. First, Mexico must have a functioning judicial system that convicts the guilty and frees the innocent. Second, a police force free of infiltration and armed with the proper training and resources. And third, a strong security presence on the streets of Mexico. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. First and worst is how environmental campaigners describe the impact of climate change on the people of Samoa in the South Pacific. The Polynesian nation of 200,000 people fears it will feel the full force of more frequent tropical cyclones and that rising sea levels will drive them from their homes on the coast with disastrous consequences for the lucrative tourism industry. From Samoa, Phil Mercer reports.
The flight time to appear is 1 hour and 45 minutes.
Samoa is a jewel in the South Pacific. Its Polynesian culture is rich and heartfelt. Then there are the reefs, beaches, and rainforests. Tourism generates about 20% of Samoa's income. But as the island's popularity increases with travellers from Asia and Europe, there is the growing threat of climate change. In February, Cyclone Geeta tore into this part of the South Pacific, causing widespread flooding and damage. Langi Poiva Sherelle Jackson from the Samoa Conservation Society believes tropical storms are becoming more frequent and severe.
This particular hotel was underwater in the highest I've ever seen in my lifetime. And it was quite dangerous for the tourists who were here because it took them a while to get out. The water came in so fast that there were still guests in the room.
So where we're standing now, we would be underwater.
Where we're standing right now, we would be underwater. Yeah. So in previous cyclones and flooding, it would come up to our hips. But for Cyclone Geeta, you know, it would have been over our heads. are standing on a multi-million dollar investment that was basically ruined, and all that money was lost, and that investment was lost because of the impacts of climate change. It will continue to worsen, but what we need to do is prepare for it. The business community, as well as the, you know, the community at large, needs to be prepared for it, because it's only going to get worse. The science is very clear on the impacts of climate change in small island developing states. We're experiencing first and worst. And these include things like flooding and cyclones, storm surges, and so forth.
Most Samoans live on a narrow coastal strip on two main islands. Viola's village near the capital, Apia, sits around mangroves, where children catch crabs to supplement the community's meagre income. Homes here are barely above sea level, and when the wild tropical storms come, they are swamped, sending villagers to higher ground.
Yeah, we all worry about when the climate change, especially the water, when it comes up, so they all cause in our homes, in our houses, especially when we have the cyclones. Yeah, the water can cause in all our valley, in our homes, yeah.
Samoa has tried to tame the Pacific Ocean with a giant seawall, but its ferocity during cyclones has caused immense damage over the years. Susanna Becken, a professor of sustainable tourism at Griffith University, says that vulnerability is harming the nation's reputation as a safe place to visit.
Every time there's an event like that, it gets harder to get back on the feet. There's also the perception, I mean, tourism is a major industry here in Samoa. If people get this idea that it's not safe, and I can see that maybe there's a little bit of that happening in the Caribbean, where there's just one hurricane after the other, people start to avoid those places. So there's this negative feedback loops, if you want.
In the early 1990s, the damage caused by tropical cyclones Ophir and Val was estimated to have been four times Samoa's annual national income. Mario Hardy, the head of the Pacific Asia Travel Association, or PATA, says vulnerable tourist destinations must develop a survival strategy.
It's important for people to prepare themselves for these situations and also to understand what is needed to be done afterwards. And this is where PATA gets involved in most instances, is after the event, in the recovery part. How do you tell the rest of the world, okay, you can come back now, you can actually come and enjoy the destinations. We need your support, we need you to come and spend your dollars on our island so that we can actually recover.
There is a general feeling here in Samoa that the developed world isn't doing enough to combat climate change. Sonia Hunter, the head of the Samoa Tourism Authority, says individuals and governments overseas need to do more.
Every little thing you do, you should really be seeing, how will I impact on climate change? What can I do more to mitigate that effect? Because the people of the Pacific may not have homes in the next couple of decades or even a decade.
Samoa's Prime Minister Tuilaepe Sailele believes climate change is an existential threat to island nations. He said that any world leader who denied the existence of warming temperatures was mentally unstable. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Apia, Samoa.
Thank you very much, Phil. And that is our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated one quarter of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. Two-thirds of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website, Twitter, or Facebook page. Find out more by visiting us at our webpage at voanews.com and then click on Digital Frontier. Tell your story and share it with the world through VOA's Digital Frontier.